Lord willing, Brother David Shannon will be teaching. And the Morgan News is after that, Mark Scott, and then Brother Tommy Kirk. So you've got to make it just another 40 minutes with me. I'm sorry, and then it will all be over, okay? So we are continuing our series of lessons on looking to the cross. Last week, we looked at the idea of God's plan for the cross. And this was a verse that we highlighted last week. Let's see here. Here we go. Galatians 4 and verse 4. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law. Now, the main purpose of last week's lesson was to point out the fact that Christ coming to this earth to die on the cross was always God's plan from the beginning. Even back in Genesis chapter 3, we see God giving mankind a glimpse of His great and wonderful plan for our salvation. This was not, as some have taught, a backup plan. It wasn't Christ's purpose to come and establish some type of earthly kingdom, and for some reason He wasn't successful in that, so then the cross became the second goal or second objective. This also wasn't the idea that the Old Testament was to abide forever. The sacrifices that were contained in the Old Testament were never supposed to be the end goal for our salvation. Now, this was a verse that I meant to cover last week, but I think somehow I might have left it out of my notes or just didn't read over it. Romans chapter 5 and verse 6, "For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly." Once again, you see Paul's emphasis on there was an appointed time that God had, and when that time had been fulfilled, Christ would come. And notice what Paul tells us. It wasn't that God was waiting for us to all of a sudden get better. This wasn't God waiting for us to get our act right, and then Jesus would come to be a sacrifice. No, while we were still weak, while we were in need, Christ came for us. Now, I would like to go over what I want to accomplish for our lesson this morning. Like I said, last week we looked more at the plan. This week, I want us to focus on the actual sacrifice that occurred at the cross. I know we have touched on this briefly in other lessons, but I want to take a more full and deeper look at the sacrifice that occurred at the cross. I would like to use Isaiah 53 as kind of a starting off point, if you will. I know that Isaiah chapter 53 is a passage that we're all very familiar with. I know it's a passage that we often turn to before the Lord's Supper or before communion. Maybe this is a passage that you have heard read out loud numerous times. I'm sure that many of us in our own private reflections have turned to these verses before. Now bear in mind, this is the prophet Isaiah giving us a glimpse of the plan and the sacrifice that was to come. Isaiah 53, let's start in verse 1. "Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him." Can't read my font back there, unfortunately. "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities, and upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed." Now, in this first section, I want us to think about what is the prophet trying to tell us. And I want to go ahead and make this comment. You know, last week, I didn't really give the class much an opportunity to have a class discussion. In reflection upon that, I wasn't very happy with that. You know, when you teach in a new setting, it kind of throws you off a little bit. And I'm not really acquainted to either a lapel mic, which I detest these things, or a larger auditorium setting. Room 5, I'm much more comfortable there. I can see everybody easily. I can hear everybody easily. I don't have to use a microphone there. I said it again last time. But what is the prophet trying to tell us in this passage? What are details that Isaiah shares with us about what the form of Christ will be like? How about we go back to the beginning verses where Isaiah tells us there will be no form of majesty or no beauty that we would desire him. What is Isaiah telling us? That when Jesus comes, his outward appearance, his physical appearance, will not be of such nature that people will say, wow, this has got to be the king. This is going to be the guy who will lead us. Now think back in Israel's history, first king Saul, right? What was different about Saul? I see some people nodding their heads. What do we read about him? He was tall, right? He was impressive, right? He had the physical appearance of a leader, okay? And while Saul was a successful king for a period of time, Israel learns quickly it's not the outward appearance of a king that should matter, right? It needs to be the heart of the king. But now let's continue on and see what else the prophet has to say. Starting back now in verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, and yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death. And although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. What is the prophet telling us in this passage? Not only was it that Christ had to sacrifice for us, but make no mistake, this was a sacrifice. This was pain and suffering that Christ did not deserve. I want you to think about something. Have you ever been called out or accused of something, right? Whether in a semi-private manner or a public fashion. Doug's giving me an odd look here. I don't know if he got in trouble for how he dressed the kids or something one time. You know, it's bad enough when we get called out on something that we actually did, right? But what feeling do you have when you're accused of something of which you are innocent? What is our natural desire? What is our natural inclination in those moments? We want to stand up for ourselves, right? We want to set the record straight. We want to make sure that people have their facts correct, right? You often hear, especially as the news is covering an issue, maybe it's a legal dispute. You know, one person's making a claim against another person, and they're saying, no, this person actually did it, right? And the news interviews the parties that are in the legal dispute, right? And what do both parties always say? We look forward to our day in court. Right? There's that idea of I'm looking forward to a moment in which justice will be served. Isaiah tells us in this passage that not only did Christ have to endure great cost, great sacrifice, but he did so innocently and without really defending himself. I want to call back to your attention when they came to receive Christ in the garden, betrayed by Judas. We all remember what Peter did, right? What was Christ's response to that? Peter, put your sword down. Not only to have sacrifice and pain placed upon you, but to be innocent of that, but also to accept it and accept it willingly. So I want to ask us this question. Oh, I forgot. Some of you may have noticed I didn't cover verse 6. I wanted to end with verse 6 in the middle of the passage. We may think about, well, why was this sacrifice necessary? Why did Christ have to endure this? Well, Isaiah tells us very clearly in verse 6, for all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. Christ paid a debt that we could not pay, right? We had sin in our ledger. We had a debt against us, and Christ suffered all of this, not for his benefit, but for our benefit. So now as we focus on the sacrifice at the cross, I'd like to ask this question. When did the sacrifice at the cross begin? You know, as we begin to consider the depth of Christ's sacrifice and the supremacy of Christ's sacrifice, I want us to think about, when did the sacrifice at the cross begin? Did it begin with the nails being placed in his hands and in his legs? Did it begin with the flogging or beating that occurred beforehand? Did it begin with the sham trial and the false witnesses and them slapping him on the face, asking him, who was it that hit you if you're the Son of God? Tell us. Did it begin with being betrayed by a man whose feet he had just washed? Did it begin with tears that became like blood? Or what about being rejected by your own people? I would put forth, as Mark discussed last week, when the Word became flesh, that in many ways, Christ's sacrifice at the cross began when he became like us, when he allowed himself to be, to a certain degree, emptied of his glory and became man. I want us to look at another passage. This is a passage that we often, like Isaiah 53, will turn to during times of communion or focusing on the cross, looking at the life of Christ. This is Philippians chapter 2. And I want to pay attention to what Paul is actually doing in this passage at the beginning. In these first few verses, I point out that Paul is actually calling us to a goal. He's calling us to an ideal in verse 1. So if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, and being in full accord with one mind. Paul is calling us towards a goal. He is calling us towards an ideal here. And what is this goal that Paul is calling us towards? What is Paul trying to get us to achieve here? What about harmony? Or maybe even unity. Perhaps we could even throw out the word equality in there. Same mind, same love, full accord. Paul desires that the body of Christ be unified. Now, divisions in the church, that was obviously a problem in the first century, right? Thankfully, we don't have to deal with that today, correct? A little bit of sarcasm there. Obviously, the first century church had divisions among Jew and Gentile lines. The 21st century church, while we may not have that distinction, we have our own distinctions. And just as the first century church had problems with being divided by ethnicity, class, education, financial, any term you can think of, we deal with that today. And so Paul is giving us this goal. Well, next Paul is going to tell us, how can we achieve this goal? How can I do this, Paul? Verse 3, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Paul is saying, in order to have this unity, this harmony that God calls us to have, we have to have the type of relationship where I'm looking out for your best interest and you're looking out for my best interest. Now, this relationship will become unequal, say, if Doug is looking out for my best interest, right, but I'm looking out for me. If I'm here only to serve myself, only to take care of myself, but Doug has my best interest at heart, then what about our relationship? We have then become, this is an older expression, unequally yoked, right? We've lost our sense of equality. We have lost our sense of harmony. Now, what I find ironic is the most famous part of this passage is not about the goal that Paul is calling us to. It's about the example that Paul gives us of what this would look like if we were to actually live this out. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Paul calls to our mind the great sacrifice that Christ made for us. Now, there's an expression here that is not really the way that we would typically talk today. What does Paul mean, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped? Well, this is probably a silly illustration, but it's the best and most concise way I can think of it. Y'all have all seen this wonderful thing that we sometimes fight with. Once again, Doug's laughing. Let me tell you, there's a reason why I don't have to reach out and grasp this morning. Right? Because it's already in my possession. Equality with God, Christ didn't have to reach out and grasp it. It was already his. But he emptied himself. Now, what does this mean? Well, this is a hard expression to explain. Let me tell you what this does not mean. This does not mean that when Christ came to this earth, in any way, form, or fashion, he lost his deity. Christ was still 100% God and 100% man. Now, I can't explain that necessarily. It's hard to define that, but that is what we learn from the Bible. But I would call to your mind, remember the transfiguration, right? What occurred at that event? What happened to the appearance of Jesus? It began to shine, right? And how bright was the light from that? As bright as humans as we could comprehend. The disciples who were present saw a brief glimpse, but a part of the glory of the Son of God. And that glory being hidden from us, from his time on earth, that's the best way I can explain that he emptied himself. But not only this, Paul continues, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed upon him the name which is above every name, so that the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth. Think about the idea that Christ became like us. He became in a form similar to us, even obedient. So now here's the question I want us to answer. What things did Christ have to endure or suffer when he came to the world to live with us? Everything. Well, yes, definitely. But let's get specific. What are some of the things that we deal with here on earth that Christ had to endure? Rejection. Let's talk about that one for a little bit. There's a passage in 2 Corinthians where Paul is making an appeal to the church at Corinth. And he basically says this, make room in your heart for me. And what Paul is asking the Corinthian church there basically is this, I wish that you would love me back like I have loved you. Isn't that a very natural human thing for us to desire? I know that holiday season, Christmas, prior to that, Thanksgiving, upcoming New Year's is a time when families get together. Sometimes that's a joyous occasion. Sometimes there's some heartache that comes with that. I think we've all had situations where there was some unequal yoked togetherness, right? And you go back to Isaiah 53, how his people did not regard him at all, being rejected by his own creation. What else did Christ have to endure? Temptation. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Temptation. Take your mind back to Matthew chapter 4, right? And what happens in that event? Jesus is tempted by whom? So after fasting for a period of time, Satan is going to offer Jesus three different things, right? Do you remember what they were? What was the first one? Now this is food, right? This is paraphrase, right? If you're the Son of God, do what? Make these stones into bread. What was the second thing that he was offered? If you're the Son of God, go up to the temple, right? Cast yourself down. Who remembers the last thing? Goes up the mountain. Everything you can see, I will give to you. Now, let's think about that, folks. There was bread, right? There was prove that you're the Son of God. Then there was, I will give you anything that you could want. Does that sound like anything else to us, possibly? I want to take your attention to 1 John. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 16. And John tells us that all that is in the world is what? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. You look at the temptations that Christ had to endure. The order might not be the same depending on how you want to categorize it. But definitely bread was first. Christ was definitely hungry. Right? Let me tell you something. I've got a toddler who throws a temper tantrum. If she doesn't eat for like 5 hours, okay, we don't even really understand. Well, I want to take that back. Some people definitely understand hunger in this country, okay? But compared to what the rest of the world has to face in other countries, those of us here in this auditorium, we don't truly understand hunger, and I hope that we never do. But then you have the idea about pride. And as Brother Bob Little had just said, Jesus being rejected by his own people, surely there was a desire there to show them, yes, I am the one you are looking for, and I'm going to prove it. But he didn't do that. And then the idea of everything you see, I will give to you. You know, we sometimes talk about how Christ was tempted like us. That's a correct expression. I definitely think that Christ was tempted more than us. No one has ever offered me and actually had the ability to give me a kingdom. And I'm glad that they haven't, because I might be wearing a crown. It'd be hard to turn that down, wouldn't it have? There is a bit of irony in there, isn't it? You think about the things that Christ had to endure. Is this the first time that we've ever read about Satan tempting someone in this way with these types of things? Go back to the Garden of Eden, right? Eve, she saw the fruit. And what did Eve see about the fruit? It was good for food, delight to the eyes, and desire to make one wise. You know, John wasn't making that up about all that's in the world is the lust of flesh, the lust of eyes, and pride of life. These are the things that we've always had to deal with, and these were the things that Christ had to deal with as well. So we've talked about temptation. What about loss? What's the shortest verse in the Bible? Jesus wept, right? We could all recite it. What was the occasion of that verse? The death of Lazarus. Have you ever wondered why Christ, who knew what was going on, who knew more than any of us could ever know about heaven, was crying? He lost his friend. You know, I probably shouldn't bring this up, but we lost our dog this week. We had to put our dog down of 6 years for me. And, you know, loss is hard. And I think I probably cried more for the dog than I have for some relatives. And those of you who have pets, you can probably understand that. And I like the relatives, too. I want to be clear. That's not what I'm talking about. I don't know if that should have gotten that much of a laugh or not. I don't know. I'm kind of worried about that. Loss is hard. It's something we all deal with. If we live on this world long enough, we're going to experience loss. But what about the loss of other things? What about Christ's burden from the loss of his disciples? You go back to the high priestly prayer. And what is Jesus praying for there? Before he's about to have to go through the pain of the cross, what is Christ praying for? He's praying for us. He's praying for his disciples. What about the loss of Judas? What about, even though temporary, the loss of Paul? How often did Christ have to reprimand or remind Paul or try to, Peter, have to encourage Peter, I need you to be faithful. Here's another loss. Now, I understand this is complete conjecture, right? I have no way of saying anything definitive about this. The Bible doesn't speak on it. You know, there was a very important person in Christ's life who was mentioned at the beginning, right? And all of a sudden, we go through, then they're no longer there. Anyone know who I'm talking about? Joseph, right? And I don't know why he ceases to be mentioned. I can only really come up with two answers. Either Joseph passed away or he left, whether of his own volition or not. I don't know if there's a third option out there, but think about that loss that Jesus had to endure also. What about just mere physical existence? John chapter 4, we read a story about Jesus having an encounter with a woman at the well, right? Well, why did this encounter take place? Well, in verse 6, we read that Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey. Have you ever thought about Jesus being tired? That's kind of an odd thing to think about, isn't it? You go back to Genesis chapter 1. You look at the work that God did through the Word, right? Created the heavens, the stars, light. Created the earth. Created the water, created the land to divide the seas, created all the creatures under the water, on the land, in the sky, created man. Hope I didn't leave a day out there. And then rested. It's not that God rested because he needed rest. We see the foreshadowing of the Sabbath there. We look at the idea of, and Paul talks about this in Colossians, that Christ was the power of God's creation. All the things that Christ created. And then he comes to earth to be tired. Now, are any of our long distance runners in here? I'm looking for Nathan or Harrison. I don't see any of the guys in here. If they are, raise their hands. I don't see them. The distance that is encompassed here from Samaria it's actually from Galilee to Judah, was about 70 miles, okay? Now, 70 miles is a great distance, but we've got some guys that worship here with us that can just about run that if they want to. Now, I know that modern footwear and modern diets and things like that help that didn't exist then. But folks, think about this. There are people right here among us today, and I don't know how to say it, and this is not sacrilegious, but hear me out, that are in better physical shape than the Son of God when he walked here. Is that an odd thing to think about? Jesus, who had the power to create everything we see around us, when he became like us, was so subject to our existence. Not that he was the above average man, not that he was the great man, not Saul, not Goliath, but he was average, just like us. I would wager that he suffered that more than any of us would probably understand. And with that, carrying the burden of his work. And that kind of segues into talking about the obedience that Christ had to endure. Matthew 26:39, the prayer in the garden, let this cup pass from me. Was the cross something that Christ was looking forward to? No, not at all. But it was something that he was willing to do. You look at the obedience that Christ demonstrates for us. Here's an odd place to think about obedience. When Christ is 12, kind of runs away from his parents a little bit, right? I don't think we would normally equate that with obedience, would we? But you look at what Christ has to say when his parents come and inquire about him. Luke 2:49, why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be about my Father's house? Here's another episode where Christ demonstrates to us obedience or being a servant. What happens in John chapter 13? John chapter 13, verse 5. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that was wrapped around him. Now that's a level of servanthood that is hard for us to imagine, isn't it? Come on down to John 13, verses 12 through 5. When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought also to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do just as I have done to you. Christ was not only obedient, but he serves to us today as the greatest example of obedience that we could possibly have. And I think these are all the things that we see Christ suffering for our sake. Well, with what time we have left, and I want us to focus our attention to a couple passages from the book of Hebrews. You know, here's the synopsis of Hebrews. Christ is the better sacrifice. Christ is the better high priest. I want us to look at some of these passages that talk about that. We're going to look at the superiority of Christ's sacrifice for what time we have left. So let's first off go to Hebrews chapter 2, at the very beginning of the book. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 through 18. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one that has the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver to all those through fear of death, verse 15, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. And why did Christ do this? For surely it was not for the angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who were tempted. What do we learn from this passage in Hebrews? Notice how the writer says that Christ became the propitiation or the substitution of sin. Once again, the Hebrew writer points out that Christ was made like us, that way that he could understand what we have to go through. That way no one could ever lay claim, well, God, you just don't know what it's like. He does know what it's like. Let's now go to Hebrews chapter 4, just two verses, time 14 through 16. Since then we have a great high priest who passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. Once again, we see this idea in verse 15. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. You think about Christ's sacrifice for us, and the Hebrews writer says that we can have confidence. That we can have confidence. I want you to think about that, folks. How many times do we get this picture of us approaching the gates of heaven and the doors just open enough where I can suck in my chest and try to slide on in? Is that the picture the Hebrews writer gives us? It's not the picture I see. You talk about confidence, you talk about assurance, you talk about knowing that your debt has been paid. Continue on. Chapter 5, verses 7 through 9. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he had suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. When you read this passage, what does it call your mind to about the loud cries and the tears? What about Christ's prayer in the garden? And once again, what makes Christ the better sacrifice? This was for eternity, eternal salvation. Every year, what did the high priest have to do? This is Old Testament law history 101. I know it's not our favorite subject at times, right? There was the yearly offering, right? The Day of Atonement. And every year, this had to take place because the blood of bulls and goats wasn't meant to permanently cast away our sin. But with one sacrifice, with one moment in time, Christ secured for us eternal salvation. Now, chapter 7, starting in verse 23. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently. Once again, the permanence of Christ, because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those... Well, I think that was two bells in one, so we are come to an end. Anyway, like I said, the point of Hebrews, Christ is the better sacrifice. Christ is the sacrifice. And thankfully, he paid a debt that we cannot pay. Thank you for your attention.